My name is Veruska Calabria, and I'm here today on the 27th of March 2010 at 3 p.m. to interview Rebecca. So, Rebecca, tell me where we are now.
In my house in Camberwell, where I had my interview for the Sky profile for my time on the plinth.
Okay, so Rebecca, I really wanted to bring you back on your experience when you were on the plinth, but I also know that since then you've had a child.
Absolutely. Well, I was pregnant with my child when I went on to the plinth and the build up to the plinth, obviously. And my time on there was all based around the fact that I was pregnant.
And when did you actually have the baby?
I had the baby 7 days, exactly 7 days after I appeared on the plinth. I appeared on Sunday the 4th of October, and then on the following Friday, I was interviewed by Clive Anderson regarding kind of my time on the plinth. And then 4 hours after my interview, my contractions that I'd been having that week kicked up a gear, and I went into established labour. And about 24 hours after that, my little boy arrived.
And how have you been since?
Yeah, absolutely fine. It's a completely life-changing thing, obviously, but yeah, I'm kind of getting used to it now. 6 months in, everything's starting to become kind of normal. But yeah, no, very, very good, very nice.
So, in your previous interview, you talked quite a bit about what life had been like for you being pregnant. I wonder what life has been like since you've had your child.
A lot harder, that's for sure. But sort of a lot more enjoyable, obviously. I mean, when you're pregnant, it's it's the build up to change. It's the build up to kind of this new part of your life, and you don't really get that in many aspects in your life. You don't get this kind of 9 month warning that everything's about to change, and it's scary. There's a lot going on in that time. But it's very exciting, but I don't think anything can really prepare you for what's to come. And it's absolutely amazing, very scary. But yeah, absolutely wonderful.
We should say your baby's here with us at the
Yeah, as you
moment.
can probably hear, he's a little greedy chomping away. But yeah, he sat here, part of the interview, much like he was in all of the plinth bits. He was all there, but this time he's skin side.
So I remember you saying in the previous interview about your worries about your health, that you had realized you had a type of diabetes.
Yeah, gestational diabetes is fairly common within pregnancy, but what it generally means is that the baby is getting too much sugar from the foods that you're eating, and tends to be born quite big. Shushy. Yeah, and could tend to be born quite big. I actually started carrying excess fluids, which made my bump very big, and meant that my baby was kind of floating around in a lot more fluid than he should have been, which can end up being dangerous because they can turn the wrong way during labour and stuff. But actually, my baby was very small. He was born at 6'10", and he went down to 5'10". What are you going to do? What are you doing? Trying to pause it for a minute.
Okay. So we just took a small break and we've moved the mic because you moved your baby around.
Yeah, that's right. He's now on the other side, hopefully settling. Hopefully.
Okay. So I really wanted to know about how you felt once the baby was born because you were worried about these health conditions that you had.
Yeah, I mean, I was mildly worried. I think I was as worried as any kind of new mother. The thought of labour is increasingly scary the closer you get to it, and I don't think any other mum can really explain what to expect. So I think anybody's scared in that kind of position, regardless of how your health is and everything. But my labour was fantastic. I mean, it basically took him 40 minutes to arrive, three pushes and he was out, which was better than I could have ever expected. But it was very scary. I mean, even afterwards, I think like most new mums, I was saying, I'll never do that again. But I'm already planning my next one. But yeah, I mean, once he was here, I mean, he was perfect. We had some problems establishing feeding for the first few days. I think I was given a bit of bad advice, and we didn't get him feeding for about 3 or 4 days, and his weight dropped, which is quite normal, but it went down quite a lot and didn't start coming back up. But in the end, we got him feeding, and yeah, as you can tell, he's very well now. But yeah, I mean, we had a few small problems, but obviously nothing that isn't quite common within pregnancy.
And what caused the fact that he wasn't feeding?
It was partially to do with the gestational diabetes, because of the amount of sugars in the womb. His blood sugar levels were quite high when he was born, and because of that, he wasn't, well, I was told he wouldn't be hungry, and not to really push trying to latch him to the breast. And so I didn't. I didn't really know any better, so I was just following the advice I was given. And in actual fact, that kind of turned out to be quite detrimental, because my milk hadn't started coming through either. Excuse you. And because of those two factors, by the time he was interested in latching, my milk wasn't coming through quick enough for him, so that delayed him by another day. And then once we realised the milk wasn't coming through, because the doctors were checking his blood sugar every day, and it was dropping, and he was latching, but he wasn't obviously getting anything because the blood sugars were dropping. So I ended up trying lots of things to try and get my milk flowing, which didn't really work, and a lot of breastfeeding counsellors were trying to give me advice, but some of their advice wasn't exactly the best advice, and wasn't very helpful. Some were very helpful, but just weren't getting things moving. And in the end, a friend of mine suggested to try an electric breast pump, and I spent about half an hour on there, and it came through, thank God. And then I was just on the borders of giving him a formula top-up, which I really didn't want to do. I'm quite anti-formula. You know, there's a lot of bad things about formula, and I didn't want to give it to my child if I didn't have to. And so, yeah, thankfully, we got my milk moving, and I got him feeding, and they let me come home. I was in there for 4 days, which was very depressing. Maternity wards are the worst wards in all of hospitals. Hospitals themselves aren't very nice. And it was just baking hot in there, absolutely boiling, even in October. I had the sun shining in on me, and then the radiators absolutely blasting in there, obviously because of all these tiny babies. And it just made things a lot harder and a lot more uncomfortable. I think it was a great experience to push me into having a home birth possibly next time. After we got him feeding, his weight kept dropping, because it's very natural that when a baby's born, they usually lose up to about 10% of their birth weight. And he lost 13%, and he went down to 5 pounds 10, and he was very small, and he looked very dehydrated. And we were having lots of skin to skin time to try and promote lots of breastfeeding. Eventually it was fine. It was absolutely fine. I did have to top up his feed, but I actually did that with donated breast milk instead of formula, because I wanted to avoid formula altogether if possible. And to be honest, I only did that because the midwife that was visiting me pushed that he needed a top up. I mean, really, if I'd think I'd got a few opinions, he wouldn't have necessarily needed a top up. I think if I'd just kept going with the feeding, but it just kind of placated the midwife and got her off my back, and she signed me off her caseload and didn't have to come round anymore, so it did its job in that sense. But yeah, eventually we got there, and as you can probably tell, he's a very greedy little feeder now and doing well, aren't you?
Okay, thanks. You talked in your previous interview about spending quite a lot of time online on all these mothers groups.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm part of quite a few groups. I mean, I was originally part of the quite famous ones like Mumsnet and Baby Centre and Baby Expert and things like that. But the things that they said didn't really sit well with me. They were quite standardised, whereas some of my ideas of parenting aren't the normal, I suppose, or the standard. And so I found it quite difficult gaining information and relating to a lot of the women on there. And I was recommended to a website called Cozy Nostra, which is also a mums-based forum. But it, the women on there are sort of very heavily promote individual choices, not just kind of following the norm, not just bottle feeding because it's more convenient and things like that. And I found that a lot more comfortable, and I've got a lot of support from there. I was due to have what's it called, an induction, quite close to when I actually gave birth, and the mums there were very helpful in helping me know what decisions I would need to make and how my gestational diabetes would affect the labour and the delivery, and kind of all my options around drugs and things like that. And they're very kind of, a lot of the mums on there are very kind of pro natural choices, which I would very much like. And I got a lot of help from there. And when I really struggled to breastfeed him to start, a lot of my support came via that forum, with women suggesting kind of ways to possibly get him going and how long I could realistically leave it before needing to top him up. Because I had the midwives coming in every day going, you've got to give him formula, you've got to give him formula, and really pushing me. And so it was really helpful to know from these online resources what my rights are and give me that extra information. And I think, you know, they probably, between all of them, got me through my pregnancy and kind of kept me sane.
Okay, so out of all these groups and possibly charities and so on that you came across about childbirth issues, mm-hmm. why did you choose Tommy?
I think Tommy's was because while I was spending time on all of these forums, I think it constantly came up that there was kind of this darker side to pregnancy, as wonderful as it all is, and everyone speaks about the fantastic sides of it. There is this fear amongst all women of you know, the things that can go wrong and that very commonly do go wrong. You know, there's miscarriage and there's stillbirth and then there's other things like gestational diabetes and all kinds of things that can possibly, you know, ruin what should be the most magical time. And, you know, it can be absolutely disastrous and heartbreaking. And it just seemed to me that while I was on the plinth celebrating what was my kind of magical birth, I should kind of make note to the fact that I am very lucky, because there are other women that aren't lucky. You know, and like the 17 women every day in the UK that go into childbirth and unfortunately wind up with not a baby at the end of it because their poor little one has died. And I think, you know, that is one of the scariest things. Until your baby's in your arms, the fear doesn't stop, but it's a lot better when you can actually see your child and take care of them yourselves. And I think that was the last point, you know, for me. I'd gone kind of through the miscarriage fear, and I'd got to a point where if he was born, you know, he had a very good chance of surviving. And I'd got to the point now where he wouldn't have been premature if he'd been born, so I didn't have that worry anymore. And it just kind of seemed that the stage that I was at, that would be my natural worry. And so that, you know, that should really be what I should raise money for at that point. It just seemed like a logical thing to do for me.
Did you have any other ideas?
I had hundreds of ideas. I mean, I spoke to everyone. I told everyone what I was going to be doing and that I was looking for, you know, a babies-based charity. And I told my midwife, and she told all the midwives that she worked with. And I got email after email after email about all these different, you know, all these different problems that have got charities attached to them and all these different things that I could draw awareness to. And it just seemed that that one would be the kind of the closest to my heart at that time.
So I noticed you were raising money for Tommy and that you basically went over the target that you had set yourself.
The original target, yeah, I upped the target after we reached it to give people an incentive so that they didn't think, oh, she's reached the target and we'll stop.
How much did you make?
I can't remember off the top of my head, but I think it was around about £500, which was brilliant, but I'd secretly hoped for more. So I may well do another something soon to try and raise a bit more for them.
Okay, so if I bring you back to the actual time when you went on the plinth,
uh-huh.
I watched your video online and I noticed you were talking to somebody who came off the plinth. I wonder whether you realised the microphones were on and people were hearing you.
Do you know what? I didn't really. I mean, I knew there was microphones, but when I'd been watching the plinth over the, you know, the weeks before it, I was watching it on my laptop and I always had the sound muted on my laptop. And so, although I'd been watching all these people, it never really occurred. I knew there was microphones. I knew they were all mic'd up. I knew that I had a microphone on. But it just didn't click in my mind that people would be listening to me as well as seeing me. So I kind of knew, but it wasn't until about 15 minutes after being on the plinth, and I think I was saying things and thinking, oh, that might not be the best thing in the world to say, that I suddenly realised that people were listening to me as well. So no, at that point I probably didn't. But I don't think there's very much that I would have changed if I had realised. A few things, maybe.
Well, the only thing why I say is because I heard you say to the person coming off the plane that you did have some other idea but you couldn't afford it. And I wonder what that was. Do you remember?
I don't remember that at all. So what else did I say? Was that it? Was it just said, I've got another idea, but I couldn't really afford to do it?
I think you were just getting to know each other and asked where he was from and that kind of thing. And I heard that. And so I thought perhaps we could learn more about the ideas that you had about going on the plinth. But if you don't remember, that's okay.
No, sorry, I don't.
So just to bring you back to the time when you went on the plinth, what was it like for you?
I was very scared before I went up there. I wasn't until that morning. Or no, I suppose maybe the day before when I was collecting everything together and I was just getting ready to kind of go, because I had to leave here very early. I think we left here at 5 a.m. We left here at 5 o'clock in the morning to get down to Trafalgar Square with everything. We had to log in early and go and kind of have the interviews and all that kind of thing. And then I think the fear really bubbled up in me when we arrived. Very naturally, I was just quite embarrassed to be in kind of this centre of attention position. I kind of changed my mind, not that enough to back out, but in a way that I don't want to do this anymore. But as soon as I got up there, it was absolutely fine. I was absolutely fine the second I got up there. All my fear kind of disappeared. Especially because there was hardly anybody in the square, which really helped. And everyone, pretty much everyone there, I knew as well, because a lot of my friends and family turned up. And about halfway through being on the plinth, a lot of traffic started to arrive as it started to kind of get to that morning time for deliveries and things like that. And vans and lorries and stuff would bib in and things like that. And I found that really exciting. I was kind of giving them a bit of a wave, and it was really nice.
Did you have any interactions with the audience or your friends even in the square?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was kind of chatting away to all of them the whole time. My best friend wasn't there, so she phoned me, and she was on the phone the whole time while I was on the plinth, so I was talking to her on speakerphone. I was talking to my nieces and nephews and my friends and stuff who all came out to see me. Mad people getting up so early to come and see me when they could have done it online, but, you know, I really appreciated it. It was great.
And what was it like immediately afterwards when you came down?
I had a bit of an adrenaline rush, I think, because it was really cold, but I couldn't feel the cold. And everyone kept going, well, you must be freezing. And I said, well, you're shivering, but I wasn't cold. I think I was just had this kind of adrenaline rush going on where I was just so excited by this thing. And I think I was very aware of how quickly it was over. You know, before I went on there, I was like, an hour is going to be so long, you know. And now it's going to be so long, and I'm not going to be able to fill the time, and I'm going to look like I've got nothing to do. And once I got up there, I didn't really have enough time to do everything I wanted to do. I felt like it had kind of flown by. I could have done longer.
So tell me for what you actually did on the plinth.
While I was on the plinth, I firstly got up there to... The main thing I wanted to do was make what I called The Watchers, which was kind of a tribute to Anthony Gormley and the little men that he made in some of his pieces. And they, for me, were representing the 17 babies that would die that day. And so that was the most important thing, was to get that on there. And I didn't tell anyone beforehand, but I sneakily stuck those to the edge of the plinth, and I really hoped that they would stay. But obviously they took them off as soon as they did, and I was kind of hopeful that it would happen. But I think they forgot two of them, which was really good, so they probably stayed up there for, sort of, for the rest of the day before they dried and maybe fell off and whatnot. So, you know, I did make my mark, so that was good. And then The other thing I did was I took up there lots of balloons with the kind of the Tommy's emblem and everything on it, and attached to them was a little envelope with a little kind of gift in and a little request to make a donation to Tommy's. See what we've got. Sorry, I'm just going to grab them a toy.
Shall I pause it?
If you want to. It should only take me a second.
Okay, we just took a small break again just to get some toys for the boy. So you were talking about your time on the plinth, and obviously you mentioned it in the previous interview about the balloons and the little watchers and so on. But you mentioned that there were things that you didn't get time to do.
The only thing I didn't get time to do was to set off as many balloons as I wanted to. You know, I went up there with some, and unfortunately, the ones that I went up there with, because of the kind of string I used, they all kind of got tied together, and I didn't really think I had time to untangle them all so that they could all go off individually. So they all went up in one big lump, which was quite disappointing, and I'm hoping that somewhere while they were up there, they untangled and made their own way. But yeah, I only got to do a few balloons while I was up there, and I'd quite like to have ploughed through lots more. So yeah, I mean, I think that's the only thing, is because of how quickly the time went, which I didn't expect. I didn't get to let as many off as I wanted, and obviously with each one of them, there was the hope of another donation for Tommy's.
So looking back at the website that you were raising money for Tommy, how much of an impact do you think the balloons, in terms of raising awareness, had?
The balloons themselves, pretty much none, unfortunately. I think it was partially because they went up in this big lump and I didn't get as many off as I wanted to. Although when we came home, we did do the rest and we just let them out from here in the hope that people would find them. But I didn't get kind of any anonymous donations or anything like that. So either mean people found them or no one found them, unfortunately. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if there's anything I could have done really to have encouraged that more, or something more I could have put on the balloons or something like that. But it was a good idea in my mind.
So what happened when you came down immediately afterwards? You mentioned the adrenaline rush, but how about comments from people?
Well, as I came down, I went over to do another interview for Sky, and a lady came up to me and she was saying, "Oh, I've just watched you up there. You know, that was wonderful." And she went, "Is that stomach real?" And I was like, "Yes, of course it's real. It's my tummy." And I think because I was in a naked suit rather than actually being naked, and because my bump was painted, it was painted with a portrait of kind of how my son would have looked inside. I think it didn't look real. So people expected it to be just this kind of performance piece with kind of this added prosthetic lump on the front. And I was a little bit disappointed about that. I mean, once upon a time in my college days, a lot of my work I kind of did use nudity for. Do you want me to where are you? Shush, little boy.
We are resuming the recording again, and the baby is now feeding, and so, you know, it's a little bit quieter. So, Rebecca, just to bring you back, you came down the plinth and you were taken for a Sky interview there and then?
Yeah, that's right. And as I said, the lady came up to me and asked me if my bump was real. And I kind of thought to myself, I mean, back in my university days where I studied photography, and a lot of my photography, I did kind of use nudity and stuff in it. So I was thinking, if it was the middle of summer, then perhaps I should have gone up there kind of nude, as it were. So that people kind of knew, but sorry.
So we took another break and we are back on again. So you were mentioning that you had the Sky Arts interview immediately after, which I assumed you weren't expecting.
No, I was expecting. I knew that they wanted to do that because they were worried that I would go into labour before the Clive Anderson interview on the Friday for Sky Arts. And so they wanted to have something to show on the show because that was live. So obviously, if I'd gone into labour before that point, they'd have this big empty slot on the show. So they wanted to make sure of that, which was probably quite good considering how quickly afterwards I went into labour.
And what happened during the interview? What did they ask you?
In the interview, I think Clive Anthony was a lovely guy. I very enjoyed meeting him. But he, it was basically just around the fact that, you know, you could go into labour any minute. Are you feeling contractions? And at that point, I had mild contractions start. Earlier in the week, I'd gone into hospital a bit early because I think I'd noticed that he wasn't moving. So, like most mums, I was a bit worried about that. So I went in for a checkup, and he was absolutely fine. I think I'd just been too busy to notice him moving or something. And at that point, you know, they'd said that the fact that he had a quiet moment can sometimes be an indication that contractions are starting. And I'd said, oh, I've had, you know, some Braxton Hicks and that. And they looked at the monitor and they said, actually, they're probably contractions. And so they'd started by that point, and they were still going on all the way through. And it's quite funny, when I was waiting to actually go into the studio with the crew behind the scenes, I'd stand there and kind of just rub my tummy without thinking. They'd go, oh, is that a contraction? Is the baby coming? Should we panic? So it was quite sweet. But I was huge by that point and very uncomfortable. But, you know, they made me, you know, feel very comfortable and looked after me well, so it's quite nice.
Rebecca, I saw this picture on the Tommy's profile website, and I wonder whether it was your belly.
Yeah, that's my belly.
It was,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's my little boy.
Which you've used as well as a picture for your profile.
Yeah, I quite liked the idea because I was obviously centering everything around him. I wanted it to be something kind of about my bump and rather than just kind of my gleaming face on there.
And I mean, it seems to me an unusually large belly.
Oh, I think he's fairly normal for a pregnancy belly, but I suppose, I mean, that was right towards the end of my pregnancy, so it's fairly big, yeah.
Okay, and would it have anything to do with the fact you had that extra water, or was that then absorbed?
I did actually manage to get my waters down somewhat, but the biggest my waters went was the equivalent of 40 weeks, which is full term of pregnancy anyway. So it would be, probably its biggest would be a full term pregnancy belly, so I wasn't abnormally large. I wasn't twins large or anything like that.
Perhaps because it's a close-up, it gives that sort of...
So you can't see it in context to me either, can you? It's just this big belly.
And I also noticed that you had a message that you wrote on this Tommy's website after you've been able to talk about what it was like, so we should discuss it. And you basically were very excited by the fact that you were meeting Alison Lapper.
Yeah, Alison Lapper, yeah, I mean, that was a real last-minute thing. Sky phoned me up just to say about the interview and just kind of dropped it in as if I already knew that Alison would be there. And I was very excited because, I mean, Alison Lapper's statue that was there originally by Mark Quinn was just such an amazing piece of sculpture. And it was something I'd always admired. And I really wanted to kind of show tribute towards that with my piece, and hence why I did kind of the naked suit or kind of nudity around my pregnancy. And it seemed kind of natural to show tribute towards that with me being so pregnant. I mean, I was a very similar state of pregnancy that Alison was in her sculpture as well. and I also, I think by kind of acknowledging it, I also wanted to kind of try and normalise it. Because I found that a lot of the people that I spoke to when it was there, if they didn't like it, their reasons for not liking it was because of the disability, and they felt that that shouldn't be publicised and things along that line. And I just felt that it was kind of unacceptable that people should even think in that way. And so I kind of wanted to draw a bit of normality towards it. And I suppose by me being in that way, people had to question exactly what it was they didn't like about her statue, and that would come down to the disability, which would have been the only kind of difference between mine and hers appearance. And so, you know, by hopefully making people realise that that was their problem, they would question their own kind of thoughts around that issue. Pause it just for a second.
Okay, we took another break just to move the baby around. So you mentioned meeting Alison Lapper. Did you get to talk to her?
I did, actually. Our interviews are separate because where I was interviewed in the studio was very high up. It was up three flights of stairs in a little room. And obviously, as Alison's in a wheelchair, she couldn't get up there. So she was interviewed in the square. And then they had a minibus outside, which was like the equivalent of a green room. And she came in there afterwards. And I got to meet her, and she was... she was very complimentary about my time on the plinth, but also she was giving me lots of pregnancy advice and talking to me kind of about what to expect and telling me about her pregnancy. She's got a little boy called Paris who was in the interview with her, and yeah, it was really nice to talk to her about that. It was great.
And you also mentioned in your previous interview about noticing that there aren't that many statues of women that have had an influence in history. And you also mentioned that you are a feminist. So I just wonder whether you want to talk to me about when you first became interested in this sort of political arena.
I suppose it was when I went to university. And I was kind of, well, I suppose maybe college, university, and I was kind of put in that point where I needed to consider kind of making pieces of art about something. And I had to question what mattered to me and where my heart lied, and to kind of figure out around there. I mean, I've had very strong female figures in my life, and strong male figures as well, but I think I've always admired the women in my life, and we've got this kind of strong independent women through our family, and I've always considered myself that. And you know, looking at the world in relation to what I've kind of grown to learn a woman should be like doesn't actually match, you know, the world's view towards women and my view are kind of different. And I feel that kind of the way of kind of projecting how I view the world should be comes within feminist issues. But I also think it depends on a definition of feminism, and I think my definition of feminism is about equality and about acceptance of equality between both sexes, whereas a lot of feminists' issues is about the superiority of the female, which, although I may feel deeply that we are very superior to men, I don't promote. But yeah, when I was at university, I started doing self-portraiture, and around that, my feminist issues came out quite naturally. And by looking at my work and realising that they were promoting this kind of feminist attitude, and that I was emulating a lot of female artists, that I then considered my own ideals a lot more deeply, and therefore obviously they came out more, and they came out in my work more, and it was kind of this ever increasing circle until I finally stood up one day and went, yes, I am a feminist.
Tell me more about your time at university. How come you chose to do photography?
I did photography. Why did I do photography? I left school with very few GCSEs because I hadn't enjoyed school. I hadn't really gone to my lessons, and I hadn't committed to taking these exams, and I was quite upset about that. And so I went straight off to college to resit all of my GCSEs, which I did, but hadn't enjoyed it as much as I hadn't enjoyed school. So I went into full-time work, and while I was working, I just kind of then decided that, you know, my life obviously should take a direction. You know, I can't just, you know, jump into full-time work and not aim for anything. That's not kind of me. And so I kind of started looking at what I enjoyed and kind of what direction I wanted to go in. And art's something that's always interested me. It's always kind of something that I've looked at and kind of wanted to know more about, and so but I've never had a natural kind of artistic talent. I can't really paint or draw or anything like that, so it seemed obvious to me that, you know, to pick up a camera and learn to use it was, although there is a very definite artistic side to it, if I didn't have that side, it's something that I could still learn. So I decided to go along that route, and I did a short course at Camberwell College and loved it, where I learned to print my own pictures and that kind of thing. And so from there I just said, yeah, this is something I want to do. But I did decide definitely to go into the art side rather than just the kind of maybe the commercial side of photography. And so I started that by doing a BTEC in art and design to learn the foundations of art, to try and kind of figure out how people draw and how people paint, even if I couldn't do it. And then from there I went into photography as a fine art at college in Derbyshire, which I do actually wish I'd stayed at Camberwell College of Arts. Although I kind of, you know, I enjoyed my time there, I think I would have got more out of my time at Camberwell. But, you know, I still feel like the photography was an amazing thing to do, you know. But yeah, no, I very much enjoyed that.
And what sort of photography were you doing? You mentioned about taking naked pictures of yourself. Can you tell me more about the style?
When I say naked pictures of myself, I wasn't doing pornography. What I was doing was, I mean, I started off obviously in the first year doing kind of all different kinds of experimental things, and I found myself looking mostly at female photographers just because it was their work that appealed to me most. And eventually I found myself looking more at me while I was kind of questioning what my interests were and why I was doing things. And not that I found my interest was me, but while I was trying to analyse what they were, I was just looking at myself so much that I thought I should incorporate that into my work. And so I ended up the majority of my work being self-portraiture, about trying to discover myself. I think a lot of that was led by the fact that I lost my mum when I was 19. She died of ovarian cancer, and so that's something that obviously affected me a lot, and I think I took about 5 years to actually mourn her, for it to come out. And so at the time when I was doing this work, it actually helped me rediscover myself, you know, and kind of delve into the kind of the depression surrounding that I had, and helped me deal with a lot of things. And I think that self-portraiture in that way for most artists that I've looked at is that kind of, you know, that question of just not only who you are, but who could you be, and who do you want to be, and who do you want the world to see. And that's, I mean, I just think that's, you know, such an amazing thing. And to be able to spend my time at university doing that, you know, was kind of a kind of double whammy, if you like. You know, I got this time to do this self-discovery and figure out who I am and explore my feminism at the same time as kind of doing this degree and figuring out photography and my loves of art and things like that.
And have you kept up your photography?
No, not really. I do take pictures of my little boy all the time, and occasionally I try and make them a little bit artistic. But when I left university, I realised that I wasn't the world's best photographer, and although I have all this interest in photography, my skill base wasn't really there. And so I actually became a photographer's agent instead. I went to work with a company that looked after a number of photographers, and I really enjoyed that side because it was looking at photographers' work and promoting that work to advertising companies and things like that, and getting to work quite closely in that and going along to the studios and seeing them being taken and having that kind of whole process and being involved in every area of it rather than kind of that high pressure photography, because it's such a difficult field to get into as well, you know. I wouldn't have stood hope. So I didn't really keep up the photography from then. I still have a camera, and as I say, I take pictures of my son all the time, and I do every now and again feel very embarrassed at my snapshots and try and get like a little arty shot, like my belly bump instead.
Well, it was a great shot.
Thank you.
So what was the name of this photographer's agency where you worked?
Horton Stevens.
And how long were you there for?
Just over a year. Unfortunately, I was working there just before the recession really started to hit. And with it being advertising, that's something that's hit kind of quite at the forefront of the recession. And they were a very small agency as well. I mean, they only had a few photographers on their books. Quite a few of them left just before then as well. And so because of that, unfortunately, they had to make me redundant.
Just to go back to the time before you went to university, you said you went to school after doing your GCSEs, and you went to work rather than, you know, continuing education. Mm-hmm. What was it like, that period of your life?
I don't know, it was an odd period. I mean, my mum had cancer just then. She'd just been diagnosed, and then she died kind of while I was, I mean, she suffered with it for a year, and then I think, what was I doing? I was still kind of just finishing college when she was diagnosed, and I'd left home already, and so my mum was kind of doing her chemotherapy and stuff, and then she died just as it was that I'd started my first full-time job as a court escort officer with Securicorps. Do you want to try and go again? Yeah.
Okay, we just took another small break. So, how old was your mum when she died?
She was 42, I think, and I was 19. So she was very young. And again, with my pregnancy and stuff, that was something that plagued me. You know, there's been other members of our family that have died of the same thing. And because of that, you know, that was something that's always played on my mind. I had polycystic ovaries, which made it difficult for me to get pregnant. And it's always something I've been aware of. And so, you know, I mean, I was very grateful to get pregnant, because there was always the chance that I might not.
You mentioned other members of the family had ovarian cancer.
Yeah, I think two of my great aunts, but I can't be 100% about that because we're not in touch with them. One of them's died, and one of them I don't really speak to anymore. But there's talk in my family that there was that.
Where are you from originally?
Originally UK.
I mean, whereabouts in England?
Always London. Yeah, always London. My great-grandfather was adopted into our family, and he's very dark-skinned, so we've got some kind of, I don't know what background, in there somewhere, but all of my family for the last few generations have all been from London, literally a stone's throw from where we're sat now. I was born 10 minutes down the road in King's College Hospital. My great-grandparents lived just over the road, so, you know, we're very kind of stanced specifically in this area.
And just to try and capture what was going on at the time when your mum got sick, were you living together or close by at the time?
No, I mean, she was fairly close by, but I'd left home already. I left home quite early. And I was living, actually, I think when she was going through her chemo and stuff, I was living in Kensington, and she was kind of around this area. But when she was ill, she was staying with her best friend, who kind of nurtured her through her illness. And that was in Orpington, so it was quite far away, but I still saw her kind of all of the time and tried to be there when I could.
And have you got the brothers and sisters?
No, I'm an only child.
And how about your father?
My dad lives in Southampton on a boat. He's quite happy there. They'd split up at the time. So my dad didn't have really anything to do with her illness. I think much to his upset, as he, you know, quite missed my mum, wanted to be there for her. But I think after my mum's death, me and my dad did become a lot closer, I think, which I think my mum would have been pleased about, because she really kind of wanted for me. But yeah, I was always very close with my dad, but my teenage years kind of made me throw tantrums, and we fell out around that time. But I think, you know, the one silver lining is that we became a lot closer after that.
Okay, thanks for sharing that with me. Just to bring you back to your interest in art, you mentioned that you really like Corbley's work because of the public element in it. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, I just like the fact that he involves the public so much. You know, a lot of artists, they produce pieces that go into galleries that only art lovers would go and see, whereas Gormley kind of not inflicts it, but he does put himself upon the public so that, you know, they're forced to face this piece of work and decide what they feel of it. His statues that he had across London and across the UK, where they were on rooftops and bridges and things like that, was absolutely amazing. And, you know, now, I mean, much to, I'm sure, his delight, people know his name because of things like that, and because of the Angel of the North. You know, it's these things that people can't avoid. people are forced to kind of face the fact that art is a part of their life and kind of have an opinion about it. And I've, you know, 10, 20 years ago, you wouldn't really had public pieces of art that people would have discussed. You know, people wouldn't would walk past the bronzes in Trafalgar Square and just see them as a statue. They wouldn't consider the art element of it. You know, it would just be this, you know, declaration towards some big kind of kernel of the past and whatever. And I love the fact that, you know, he makes us be aware of the art in our environment. And, you know, by being aware of his work, it I hope could make others more interested in art and seek it out. But for people that aren't, you know, they, I suppose they must look around them and question what is art and what's not.
Now, to look at the connection with the online audience, of course, you had your profile on the One Another website, and then, of course, also on the Tommy's website, the fundraiser site. How did that affect what you did and what you might have left out of your performance?
Sorry, can we just pause for 1 second?
Yes, sorry.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, we took another break as you were giving your baby something for his teeth, right?
Teething powder, yeah, that's right.
So just to talk about the impact of the online audience, you had your profile on the One Another site where you got lots of comments afterwards, but also you had your Tommy's sort of profile beforehand. And how do you feel having this sort of online interaction with people affected what you did and what you might have left out as well?
Sorry. I think actually it made me more determined to do what I originally said I did. I think once I've said that I'm going to do something, it's very hard to turn around and go, actually, I'm not going to do that. I also had a couple of pages on Facebook. And so I have sort of maybe 200 people in my contact list on Facebook. And so knowing that all of those had seen what I'd said, I was kind of committed to do it. I had some problems arranging the things that I'd said I would do. It took me a long time to find the naked suit that I wanted and the helium for the balloons. The company that that I was kind of hoping to buy the helium off of, or rent the helium off of, were really rude to me. They were really horrible when I phoned them up, and they just had no interest in helping me out whatsoever. And I would have paid full price for it, but because they were so rude, I just didn't want to use them anymore. And then thankfully, one of my friends who runs a children's play centre in Surrey Quays, she actually loaned me free of charge their helium canister for their balloons that they use, and she was an absolute godsend. And she also provided the face shush. She also provided the face paints that we used to do the portrait of my son on my stomach. So she was brilliant. Laura Spence, her name is. Excuse me. Take that. And so that was an absolute godsend. That was all kind of that was all very last minute that came through as well. You're in a very bad mood, little boy, aren't you? All right, noisy. What's this? Okay. Yeah. So I think the kind of that online interaction just forced me to do what I originally said I would do. You know, I think if nobody had known, I might well have changed my entire idea very last minute and gone up there and done something completely different. But I didn't want to let myself down by doing something completely different to what I said I would do. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. So just to really bring you back on the whole experience as a whole, do you think it changed you in any way?
Yes and no. I mean, I don't think it changed me as a person, but I think it very much helped me I can't think how to word it, to kind of have the strength of my convictions, you know, to kind of publicly declare that, you know, means that you have to mean it. You know, you have to be able to stand up for what you believe in once you've told the world you believe in it. And you know, I do think it gave me that strength and you know, the courage to do it, to do it so publicly, you know, and now everybody knows, you know, the my time on the plinth is attached to my Facebook page so that anybody can see it. So you know, I mean, I face questions from friends and stuff that ask me all the time, and you know, I have to believe in what I'm telling people I believe in. You know, I have to know about that. You are so noisy.
Okay. So we're taking another break, and you've given the baby to your husband.
I've got a shot of him, yeah.
And really, this last part of the interview is very much about reflecting on the impact of the experience on yourself and your family and friends,
okay.
And perhaps this particular charity as well. So if you'd like to talk about those three elements.
Where to start? I don't know. I suppose doing what I did it partially in tribute to my son, obviously, him coming into the world. It was kind of an announcement of his intended birth. And also, I wanted to do something to kind of shout about the things I believed in publicly for him to see one day, for him to know, you know, about these things that I believe in and how important it is to stand up and tell the world what you believe in and to do something about it. You know, it's all very well and good to have these beliefs, but unless you do something about them, unless you kind of you stand up for what you believe in, then, you know, you haven't really got a society, you've got individuals, you haven't got, you know, this community. And so I think by doing that, I've kind of left this, not legacy, but, you know, this kind of mark for my son to see, for him to know kind of who I am, especially if anything was to happen to me before he was old enough for me to teach him my ideals and what I believe in. And so I feel that, you know, in that sense, on my son and on my family, you know, I definitely kind of have done it for the mark on him, on them.
And how has it affected your family?
I mean, I don't think it's affected them as such. You know, it's just kind of perhaps the effect that it will have on them. You know, hopefully it will have this effect on my son. For me, my family is my husband and my son. You know, and I do have my dad, but I don't see him very often. And obviously I've lost my mum. So, you know, my family is very much my immediate family. You know, I don't think necessarily my time had an effect on anyone. Perhaps if I'd gone up there naked, they may have had more to say about it. But as it stands, I mean, I think they all think I'm a little bit crazy, but I think they always knew that. I just think this was the cherry on top. So yeah, I don't think there was much of an effect, but I do know they're kind of, you know, they're proud of me for getting up there and doing something so publicly that I don't think a lot of them would even consider doing.
And how about this Tommy's charity? How your performance, how did it affect?
Well, they're quite a big charity anyway, so I think mine was just kind of a drop in the ocean for the amount that they do for people and the amount that people do for them. You know, I feel good to know that I've hopefully made a small difference for them. You know, that they've got this kind of extra funding and they've got this extra acknowledgement from the public of what they do. You know, I hope that some people went on there and investigated more about the charity and about kind of the broad aspect of things that Tommy's helped with and how they became founded. And that people do just kind of keep in mind the darker side of pregnancy and these issues that can go wrong. You know, I hope that, I mean, for the most part, most people are very lucky with their pregnancies, and I just hope maybe that helps them appreciate that.
Okay, thank you.
That's okay.
I wanted to ask you more about your time in university, and you mentioned about your degree in retrospect was a way to make sense of losing your mum.
Yeah, I think I used it for that. I did. I think, to be fair, I was very much looking for a way to do it. I didn't acknowledge her death for a long time. I kind of brushed it under the carpet and kind of carried on with my life. And I think anybody that's done that will know it becomes like a bubbling pot. And at some point, you know, you have to deal with that. And I got to that point while I was at university. And I could very well have backed out of university and run back to London and, you know, hid my head under the carpet again. But I stayed and I dealt with it. And, you know, I think looking at the strong figure that my mum was in my life, led me to the things that I did in my degree, you know, and effectively to my time on the plinth eventually. I mean, I would say that was very linked to a lot of the work that I did. You know, it was very similar in a lot of ways. And I think, you know, I very much kind of discovered more about our relationship, and kind of who I am because of that relationship.
So what was your mum like?
She was a great woman, but we were very similar. And so a lot through my teenage years, I was a very stubborn teenager. So I wasted a lot of time with my mum being a sulky, stubborn teenager and didn't get to know her as well as I could. And I think that was part of the thing that I was coming to terms with whilst kind of discovering about our relationship. I mean, my mum was a very strong, independent woman. She very much stood up for what she believed in. And, you know, she was a great role model for me. It was just unfortunate I couldn't really see that or appreciate that when she was here to give it to me. I think, you know, that can't become more apparent than when you have a child and your mum's not there. I mean, luckily I've got friends that are going through the same thing. My best friend had her son 4 months before I did, and she lost her mum about the same time I did. And so I think, you know, we did speak a bit about how she felt about that. And so I was a little bit kind of forearmed about how I might feel when it came down to it. But I think, yeah, I would like to have known what kind of grandparent my mum would have been. And I would like to know more about what kind of parent she was to me, because although I still have my dad, men are absolutely useless at remembering small details and facts about things like that. So he can tell me the big things, but the little things, you know, a girl really needs her mum for. And I think, you know, I just, you know, I think her influence on me as a parent would be a very good thing as well. You know, I do feel her influence in a lot of the decisions I make. In things that I could imagine she would have done and that I've heard from other family members she would have done. But, you know, I can only wonder what her direct influence would have been like.
Do you know much about her life?
In what sense do you mean?
About her growing up, what she did, about her parents.
Yeah, I mean, her mum died a year after her. And I was very close with them as well. I lived with them for a while. I know some. Her best friend is still alive, and she was friends with her from when she was about 12. So a lot of kind of that teenage years I can get. Her brother's still here, so kind of from the childhood I've got that. I mean, she had a tough upbringing herself. I mean, her father used to be an alcoholic and would beat up her mother, and she witnessed that and experienced it. And I think that helped shape kind of how strong she was to be in the face of something like that. So yeah, I do know stuff. I know bits about her life. I know kind of what helped shape her into the person she is. I know bits and pieces about who she is. You know, I have someone from each area of her life that I can turn to and ask questions about, and you know, they do speak openly and warmly about her.
What kind of art did you produce that helped you resolve some of these issues when you were at university, making sense of death?
Well, the art I produced, the end result wasn't necessarily what found me answers or helped me resolve it. I think it was my research along the way, looking into different artists and different women and about the things that they'd been through. And why they produced the art that they produced, and then kind of questioning how that reflected on me and what I could do within that that would reflect in my work areas of me. There was just pieces where I reflected specific artists whose names are completely out of my mind. I've been trying to remember their names throughout this entire interview. I think I've still got baby brain and I just, names completely obliterated. But, you know, I would copy work of Cindy Sherman, for instance, who would take on other personalities. She kind of did these film stills where she became someone else and kind of covered up who she was, while still being there beneath it. And I think that was quite significant for me, because there was this kind of mask for me where I was covering up the pain and the mourning that I had underneath. and about how that came out. And I really want to think of the name of this other artist. There was just one artist, and she was so significant in my work, and I just can't think of her name at all. She was a Mexican woman. Do you know her name?
Frida Kahlo.
There you go, thank you. It was on the tip of my tongue. She was so influential in my work. I loved her independence. I loved how she was so strong about who she was. So combining that with Cindy Sherman's work about how she was hiding behind, and with me trying to find out who I was, and this kind of significance of who she was, you know, I very much kind of embraced that. There was a painting that Frida did that was her in her husband's suit, sat in a chair, and I loved that, because although it was kind of looking at the influence her surroundings had on her, at the heart of that picture was everything that she was, and a lot of my work kind of came from that. I mean, my nudity came into it when it was about me kind of discovering what it meant to be a female, and about what that means in the outside world, and about the symbolism attached to that. I kind of used things like Aphrodite as kind of the symbolism of kind of everything that it should be to a female, but how you look at that in a modern perspective, and about how women have been viewed and possibly objectified through the ages, and how they've been this amazing kind of symbol of who they were, but that's been downtrodden, and now we're kind of trying to raise that back up, and all of these things along the way. But I think the way that connected to my mum was finding where my strength came from, and why I feel that this strong woman should be kind of how every woman should be, and how women should be viewed. And I think that does come kind of directly from my mum, and the fact that she, not necessarily, she wasn't, oh, I don't know, I can't ask her, but I wouldn't say she was a feminist as such. She was just very confident and happy with who she was, and you know, that's very important, because I think that's one of the things of feminism. If you compare it to another prejudice such as racism, I think the way that you will eventually get over racism is not by the promotion of you know, other races, it's by the normalizing. And that's the same as feminism. If I act like a normal strong female, and that there's nothing I need to stand up and scream about, that this is the way it should be and it's very normal, then hopefully at times it will become normal. And I think I still use that now with things like my breastfeeding. You know, breastfeeding in public can be quite a daunting thing. You know, people look down on it, you get looks from people tend to be quite embarrassed about it, but it should be a very normal thing. It's been here for as long as we have, you know, there was no other way to do it before a few hundred years ago. And you know, I'm very much embracing that as well. With the problems that I had in hospital, I demand my right to breastfeed anywhere I want. You know, and the media has been throwing up a lot of problems with people, with women finding it difficult to breastfeed in public, and I'm training at the moment to be a breastfeeding peer counsellor, so that I can support these other women that may have problems initialising their breastfeeding, but that also may find problems in public with you know, these archaic views that obviously breasts are a sexual implement and not for feeding their children. You know, there are just these ridiculous views out there, and I just want to stamp them all out personally.
So you are trained to do this as a career?
It's not a career as such, although it could be a kind of a progression to career. At the moment, it's a voluntary position within Southwark Council. It's an initiative that Southwark are doing, and we run things called breastfeeding cafes, which are open to all women. Whether you breastfeed or not, if you've just got questions about breastfeeding, that kind of thing, and women come along there and they can resolve anything. And it's also a social thing, so women can meet up and just kind of support each other in any way they need. And we have midwives and health visitors there, but we also have breastfeeding peer counsellors, which are people that are currently breastfeeding, have breastfed, and can help you on a kind of one-to-one basis of what it's like to be a breastfeeding mother, away from that kind of that medical kind of thing that the midwives and the health visitors may have. It's more of a kind of own level one-to-one thing, and it was directly because of them that I managed to get through the kind of problems that I had. So kind of I'm very grateful for them. So I wanted to kind of give that back as well.
That's fantastic.
I hope so. I've got to get through it. Yeah, I'm in kind of month one of 3 months, so it's going really well. It's very interesting.
And what would you say is important to you right now in your life, apart from your child?
Apart from my child, I don't know. I can't think outside of that bubble, really. I think for me, I mean, I've got to say, I am one of these people that's completely enveloped in my child's life. I think for me, the most important thing is to make sure that my child and any subsequent children grow up with the strong views and values that I have. You know, I'd be devastated if my boy grew up to kind of look down on women and didn't see them as equals. You know, this is my thing, is to normalise, you know, this equality, but through my children now, and by doing that, you know, they can go forward and do that for me. But alongside that is also this kind of human rights thing. You know, I think, although I've always been interested in these things, I can't say that having my child hasn't just exploded them beyond all belief. You know, I think I very much put my head in the sand with things before, and now things like my right to breastfeed in public is something that, you know, I'm actively fighting for. Things like I've given up any chocolate that isn't fair trade. So this is very recent, but I've been made aware of kind of the amount of child slaves that there are out there. 12,000 child slaves that are known in the Ivory Coast to produce chocolate, and that's as well as the 100,000 child workforce that are doing it. And I think probably because I've got a child, I now can imagine my child in that circumstance. It's just not right. You know, there's nothing right about that. So I've kind of banned it all from my life, and you know, I'm going forward to try and make the difference.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, I miss chocolate.
So I hope you've enjoyed the interview today.
Yeah, I have. Amongst all its little problematic things, I hope they weren't too much for you.
That's absolutely fine. Don't worry. And thank you very much.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you.